Welcome back, everybody. This is Mark Steiner here on The Mark Steiner Show. We want you to join us here at 410-319-8888. I want you to write us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Tweet us at Mark Steiner or jump on our Facebook pages, which I'll be checking, because some very important issues we're about to wrestle with our guests, and want you to join us for that. As I said earlier, you know, this is the 1973, this is the beginning of the Watergate hearings. Some people are questioning whether some people wrote an article I read this morning early asking the question whether President Barack Obama is the new Richard Nixon when it comes to endangering our civil liberties. We'll talk about that. That is a real serious conversation I think America has to have with itself. It's also the 45th anniversary of the Catonsville Nine, when they burned draft records and civil disobedience against the war in Vietnam. And that many people now are questioning, do we need more of that in America today when it comes to what we are facing in the future? So we are going to start this conversation off talking about the Internal Revenue Service and what some people are alleging is the targeting of the Tea Party. And then in the next half an hour after that, we will be leaping into the whole question of the Associated Press and the seizing of those phone records and what that says. We are joined here right now by Ari Berman, who is a contributing writer for The Nation, Jordan Bloom, associate editor of The American Conservative, and Gabe Rotman, legislative counsel and policy advisor at the American Civil Liberties Union's Washington Legislative Office. And Ari Berman, Jordan Bloom, Gabe Rotman, welcome. Good to have the three of you with us.
Morning, Mark.
Thank you. Morning.
Morning.
So this is you know, when you first saw this piece arise over the investigation of what was going on with the IRS and the 501c4 organization specifically targeting the Tea Party, it was not sure what we're looking at here. It looked like an abuse just of the conservative movement, the Tea Party movement. But one of the things, here's where I'd like to start, if I might. And let me start for a moment with you, Ari, because I know you're only with us for the first half hour. The stuff you've been writing, in some ways, have been trying to get under this, saying the issue you think is broader than that. Could you lead us there?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, I don't think anyone disputes that the IRS messed up, that they were ham-handed, that they certainly seemed to single out certain organizations for scrutiny, and that the scandal certainly looks bad. I think it looks worse than it actually is, because I don't think people are focusing on the root cause of the scandal, which is the fact that the Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court in 2010 unleashed a flood of these so-called social welfare groups applying for 501c4 tax-exempt status, who were really political organizations. And what you had is, shortly after the Citizens United decision, came the birth of the Tea Party, and you have a flood of groups who are petitioning. Well, the Tea Party happened before that, but what happened is that you had a flood of groups petitioning the IRS, largely on the right, asking for 501c4 status. What we saw in the 2010 election, but particularly in the 2012 election, was that groups were spending huge amounts of money. For example, Karl Rove's group, Crossroads GPS, spent at least $70 million on the 2012 election. And these are groups whose activities are not supposed to be primarily political in nature. They're not supposed to be groups whose sole purpose is to defeat or to back candidates. And so I think what you have here is a very serious scandal of groups who are flouting, certainly, if not the actual law, certainly the intent of the law in terms of qualifying as social welfare groups. I think the thing that the IRS did wrong is focus on small Tea Party groups who weren't big players, as opposed to these big organizations like Karl Rove's group, or on the Democratic side, the Obama-affiliated groups, who are taking advantage of the tax code right now in major ways to conduct their own political agendas.
So Jordan Bloom, pick up where Ari left off here. I mean, whether you see this problem as a political issue affecting the Tea Party, or as Ari just concluded, is the problem is part of the deeper part of the problem here is where 501c4s have gone and the danger to our political process. Some people argue that they've taken us.
Yeah, well, the first thing I'd say is that there were a few big groups that were targeted in all of this, TPP, but it is indisputable that there has been this influx of post-Citizens United applications for 501c4 status. But what the people... So if this is just an issue of backlog and having to come up with new criteria, as the IRS officials have claimed, then the question that those people have to answer is the nature of these questions. Some of them, especially the donor issue. So some of these groups were asked to disclose their donors. And IRS officials have to know that 501c4s do not have to disclose their donors.
Right.
So this has the appearance not of pettifogging, but something actually, you know, malicious. Yeah. So that's the question that they need to answer.
Now, say that way, malicious in what sense?
Trying to hold them up deliberately. It possibly illegal. Eric Holder has announced a criminal investigation into this.
So, I'm going to come back to that point as well. And Gabe Rotman, but one of the things I think here, and this is why things are, you know, we can look at things in a very simplistic way, in linear ways, but I think the complexity of it all is what's been getting to me. I'm going to come back to the partisan political question in a minute about what may be being held up. The other part that you wrote about that I think is really important to kind of, that you and Michael McLeod Ball wrote about, to address is, you know, when people harken back to the United States defending the NAACP, saying you don't have to say who are your donors, because people were in fear of their lives for fighting against segregation in the South.
Mm-hmm.
We've been using that same argument, saying that 501c4s don't have to yield who they don't have to disclose who their donors are. These are very different circumstances. And it seems addressing very different items, but the effect is very different, but the process is the same.
Well, so that the NAACP v. Alabama case that you're referring to, that's why 501c4 social welfare organizations don't have to disclose their donors. You know, and I think that's actually the right result if you're talking about legitimate social welfare organizations. But let me just step back for a second, because one of the issues here is, you know, this is an unusual IRS scandal. These things happen a lot, you know, and they happen under administrations, Republican and Democrat. It's actually similar to an audit against the NAACP under the last Bush administration. And fundamentally, the problem is that, you know, it's very conceivable that this was limited to, you know, frontline career staffers who were trying to find a shortcut to deal with this influx of applications. But that's almost irrelevant to the question, because when you're talking about the inappropriate criteria that the Treasury Department's auditor identified and confirmed were used, the fact is those inappropriate criteria are ideologically based, and that's the fundamental problem here, and it's something that we need to prevent from happening again.
So what does that mean, though? I want to kind of probe that even deeper and then come back to our other guests. Does that mean that you think that the issue around probing the Tea Party organizations is partisan, and that's the problem, or is the problem deeper and more complex than that?
No, the problem is the lack of clear rules that define that first of all define what is partisan political activity, that if you engage in too much of it, you lose your tax exempt status, and then second, how much is too much. Both of those questions, what's partisan political activity and how much is too much, are completely up to the discretion of these frontline IRS staffers. And that's the fundamental problem, is that they have to engage in this open-ended, quote-unquote, facts and circumstances inquiry that allows for this kind of selective enforcement, which is unacceptable against both the left and the right.
So what should we be looking for here?
Clear rules.
And what would clear rules mean to Jordan Bloom in this case to you?
Well, I think the lesson here is a little bit different than that. It's that whenever you're investing some sort of executive branch office with deciding what's too political, what's not, you're not actually putting that in the hands of a neutral authority. You're putting that in the hands of a political authority. You're turning over campaign finance to the political process. And so the lesson here is that there's too much campaign finance regulation, basically, not enough.
So is your take the same? Not enough? Too much?
No, I mean, I have a completely different take, which is that what's happened to the IRS is they've been put in an incredibly difficult position by the fact that the Citizens United decision essentially unleashed a Wild West system of campaign finance disclosure, where you have groups that don't have to disclose their donors, that are engaging in political activities that are completely different than their tax status should allow, and there is no authority stepping in and doing anything about it. The FEC, the Federal Election Commission, is paralyzed. Congress is unable to pass any sort of new disclosure requirements to clarify this law. So the court has taken a very, very, very laissez-faire policy with regards to campaign finance reform, basically saying anything goes. And now you have a situation where in the last election at least $250 million was spent by groups that we don't know the identity of. And to me, that should bother you whether you're a liberal or you're conservative, you're on the right or the left. I mean, we should know who is spending all this money to influence American elections if these are, in fact, major players. In many respects, these 501c4 groups, groups like Crossroads GPS, groups like Priorities USA, Bill Burton's group on the Democratic side of the aisle, these are almost groups that are more important than political parties nowadays because of how much money they can raise and how much they're able to spend with no disclosure. And so to me, we really have to clarify our campaign finance laws. At the very least, I think we need to clarify who can be considered a 501c4 group, what the criteria is to evaluate them. And I think there certainly were some people at the IRS who were over-eager in terms of trying to investigate certain groups. But if you look at the big Inspector General report that was issued about the IRS, it didn't say that this was the result of some sort of deliberate campaign against the right. What it said is it was a result largely of some individual screw-ups and some bad management. And I think some of that, quite frankly, was because of the fact that they were operating in such an unclear and difficult environment in terms of trying to regulate the flood of new applications coming in as a result of the Citizens United decision.
Is this Jordan?
Yeah. Well, there have been the idea that it's just confined to lower-level frontline employees has been pretty much debunked. Like in the initial apology by the Exempt Organizations Division head, Lois Lerner, there were a number of just untruths in her statement. She said it was confined to the Cincinnati office, which is not true, and also the Cincinnati office is not just a random frontline office. It's where these exemption claims are processed. And also, you know, if stepping back for a minute, if these Tea Party organizations had the ability to do so, they probably would have organized themselves as corporations and wouldn't be subject to all of this stuff. So you have a situation in which these organizations are forced through this 501c4 approval process and then are shut down. And that has the look of stifling political speech, right? And I think that's the basic problem.
But they weren't shut down. Every single application was approved.
And so, a number of them withdrew.
Scrutiny, but it wasn't ultimately like they were shutting down in mass Tea Party organizations that were petitioning the IRS.
No, that's true, but there are dozens of applications that are still outstanding.
Well, one of the things that this is an important part of this. There's two pieces that I'm hearing coming out of what I've been reading and hearing and what the three of you are talking about. And Gabe Rotman, it seems to me that part of this is you've seen – whether it's this administration, some people would argue this administration kind of interfering with Tea Party organizations. We saw that, as you have pointed out as well, that in the Bush administration's targeting of the NAACP in very similar ways under other civil rights organizations and largely based in communities of color.
Mm-hmm.
So that's let's speak to that problem. That's A. Then there's B is the larger problem of this entire way we fight politics in America and the new role that 501c4s are playing could be very dangerous to our democracy. Let's leave that for a moment and come right back to that. Right now, is there an issue around partisan targeting of organizations, do you think, Gabe?
Well, so this is exactly the point, right, is that it almost doesn't matter whether the partisan targeting is advertent or inadvertent. It's quite possible that what happened here was an honest mistake. But that almost doesn't matter because you're talking about one of the most powerful government agencies that's vested with vast discretion to identify and make very hard judgment calls about what constitutes political activity and how much is too much. And that kind of discretion invites this kind of selective enforcement. It's almost invariable. If you grant that kind of discretion, it's going to be misused. Even if that misuse is, you know, simply because people are trying to cut corners and do things faster. And so we need to pare back that discretion. That's what we need to do.
So, and how do we do that?
But by, and there are, you know, there are two ways in this particular instance, right? Either 501c4 organizations are not allowed to engage in any partisan political activity, and we clearly delineate what constitutes partisan political activity, as the Supreme Court has required the regulators to do, going back to the 70s, you know, or we take the gloves off and we say that 501c4 organizations can engage in unlimited political activity, and it takes, you know, the IRS out of the equation there. You know, conversely, we could also put the determination of what constitutes partisan political activity and how much is too much back at the FEC, and then address the question of how to make the FEC work better, which is a difficult question, because the FEC works the way that it does in order to prevent the politicization of campaign finance reform, or campaign finance regulation, excuse me.
So, I mean, does anyone deny, let me start with you, Jordan, and go to Ari, does anyone kind of deny that the work of Crossroads GPS or Americans for Prosperity or Americans for Tax Reform or some of the other groups I can name on the liberal side are operating as partisan political organizations in the political process with no one knowing where these billions of dollars are coming from, hundreds of millions of dollars are coming from in our political process? Does anyone, is that an untrue statement, Jordan?
Well, that's almost certainly the case, but I think the impact on, you know, the integrity of American democracy of this sort of thing is vastly overstated.
Why is it overstated?
And I think it relies on this idea that people are deeply convinced by television ads. It's just ridiculous.
If that's the case, then why are people spending their millions of dollars to do it?
Because I don't know. That's a good question.
I mean, people like the Koch brothers and Karl Rove and Grover Norquist and others, they're not dumb people. They're not stupid.
Sure, yeah,
they're strategic thinkers.
But the idea that there's undermining American democracy in some fundamental way, that we need to do something about it, we need to shut down their ability to, you know, spend money for political speech, is a kind of a dangerous idea. And it inevitably leads to turning the adjudication of what constitutes political speech over to bureaucrats like the IRS, and you get into these sorts of problems.
Right.
Ari?
Well, I mean, I just think it's deeply absurd that people would be accusing the Obama administration of engaging in this unprecedented culture of secrecy, while at the same time defending the ability of groups to spend hundreds of millions of dollars without disclosing their donors. I mean, you're either for more transparency or you're not. And we don't know who is funding these campaigns. We don't know why they're funding them. We don't know what they're getting as a result. And I think it's laughable to expect that people could be giving all this money in secret and not want something in return, and that wouldn't lead to a further corruption of our democracy, a further undermining of people's confidence in the political process. No one's talking about shutting down political speech. The question is, should people be able to give millions of dollars anonymously to influence U.S. elections? And I think it's pretty obvious, at least to the public, that shouldn't be the case. And so people can give money in a variety of different ways, but I think we do need new campaign finance laws to say that you need to disclose what you're doing. And number two, if your primary goal is to win or lose campaigns, that you shouldn't be in a tax bracket that's reserved to groups that are doing legitimate social welfare work. I think there's been a large-scale abuse of the tax code here, and that is what has been lost in the coverage thus far of the IRS scandal.
So, I mean, Gabe Rubin, I mean, does this all harken back to Citizens United? Is it more than that? I mean, it just seems to me that as more I read, and I think more Americans read, we're really wrestling with and getting confused by what's under all of this. I mean, this is more than just, it seems to me, a partisan attack on the Tea Party. We're talking about something much more fundamental here.
I, I think there's a lot of confusion over sort of what Citizens United did and, you know, what exactly we're talking about. You know, on a concrete level, it does appear that the flood of applications to the IRS for groups seeking tax-exempt status was a result of the Citizens United decision, which said that corporations and labor unions are allowed to engage in independent expenditures, which means express advocacy for or against a candidate, but that is not coordinated with a campaign. So if you're a nonprofit corporation and you believe in, that you believe in fiscal responsibility, and you want to put out an ad criticizing a member of Congress for their position on the Recovery Act or what have you, you can do that as long as you're doing it completely independently of the campaign. What's happened, though, is that there's concern, and legitimate concern, over whether these independent expenditures are truly independent. And that's where we need to focus our attention to tightening up the rules. But I think that this particular case, while Citizens United is sort of hovering in the background, it's not exactly about Citizens United, right? It's about granting an agency like the IRS vast discretion to make very difficult legal judgments about what constitutes political activity and how much is too much. And that's the root of the problem here.
So how do we get to that root? Jordan, Ari, do we agree that's the root of the problem, or is it something else? Jordan?
Well, I think the big difference between expecting transparency from an American Crossroads and expecting transparency from the government is that the government is doing things in the public's name. And I don't think there necessarily should be an expectation that we know where every dollar of money being spent on political speech comes from. I think that's a dangerous expectation, actually.
Absolutely.
Why is it a dangerous expectation for us to want to know who's trying to put money into our political process, whether it's right or left?
Because it leads to situations like this. It politicizes the process.
Ari, what does that mean to politicize the process for you?
Well, I think that if we had clearer campaign finance rules, if we had better disclosure, if we had smarter regulation, then this scandal wouldn't have happened in the first place, because the IRS would have had much clearer guidelines to follow, and it wouldn't have had to be doing the sort of watchdog role that should fall on the shoulders of other organizations, whether it's the SEC or the Congress. And so, I think that basically there should be full transparency across the board. I think it's a little ridiculous to expect the government to act in good faith, but not the groups that are petitioning the government to act in good faith. And I think that we still haven't addressed at all the root cause of this scandal, which is the tremendous amount of secret money coming in to U.S. elections. And so, we can reform the IRS all we want, but as long as that root problem exists, there are going to be issues going forward, because it's just so hard to get a handle on what's happening when we're in a situation where there just is no disclosure, and you have groups spending hundreds of millions. It's probably much higher than that, because there's so few reporting standards in terms of what we know these groups are doing, that in the next election, it's very likely it could be billions of dollars of secret money. And that is going to lead, I think, to a further corruption of the political process. So if you're worrying about the political process being corrupted by Washington bureaucrats or whomever, I think you have to realize that the money that is being spent to influence elections is going to lead to a further corruption, no matter who is in office.
So folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. And the question is to me, maybe I'm missing something here, Gabe Rotman, but this is, as I read more and more of this and look at our history, and I'll just lay it out there, it seems to me that the battle, let's say, to end segregation in America,
mm-hmm.
That some of us fought in, actually, there's a perversion, it seems to me, of what was started as a way to protect people's lives so they can say, we're contributing to end segregation in Alabama or Mississippi in 1961. where you might lynch me, kill me, beat me, jail me, torture me, if I want you to, if you knew who I was, to saying now that this is now a world where that extends to corporate America, that can say I can write a check for any amount I want to, and you don't know have to know who I am to influence the political process. Something has shifted here, and to me in a very frightening way.
I'm not sure it's necessarily a perversion. The mechanism, right, and that underpins why we allow for some donor anonymity in this case, is the same whether you're talking about the civil rights context or partisan politics today on either side. I personally, when you're talking, and this is not to confuse the issue, but when you're talking about direct contributions to candidates, which are still highly regulated, I personally won't go over the disclosure cap because I don't want my name out there on the internet because I work for a nonpartisan organization. And I'm personally uncomfortable with that, with being publicly identified, as supporting a particular candidate. And the same thing applies when you're talking about groups that advocate on particular issues, be it on the left or the right. If there is not some measure of anonymity, then a lot of these groups can't do their work because they can't source these donations. So there's definitely a chilling effect on speech and on robust public discourse if there's too much disclosure. So it's not, I disagree that there should be blanket disclosure for anybody that gives to a group, that engages in partisan political activity. The public has an interest in knowing who is spending great amounts of money to influence the political process, but you need to draw lines.
Ari?
Well, I think we're just in a difficult situation in terms of, defining what is in the public interest and what is and isn't. Social welfare and what is, in fact, political activity that should not have the same kind of tax-exempt, no-disclosure status. And I think those rules need to be clarified, and I don't see why this is something that there can't be a bipartisan agreement on to try to clarify the rules so that we don't have, for example, well-meaning social welfare groups, whether it's on the left and the right, being confused with the likes of a Karl Rove or a Grover Norquist or the Koch brothers. I mean, to me, there seems like there's definitely a distinction in terms of the wide array of 501c4 groups, and there needs to be some clarity on who is deserving of this status and who isn't deserving of this status going forward.
Now, do you disagree with that proposition, Gordon Bloom?
Well, I think it's dangerous to get into the arena where it's okay for anonymity for civil rights groups, but not okay for corporate groups. But it's an instructive example because it was clear, even though donor anonymity was an important thing, giving it to civil rights activists, their agenda was clear from what they were doing, right? They were fighting to end segregation. In the same way that if you watch an Americans for Prosperity ad, it's pretty clear that they want low taxes, less regulation, et cetera. So the idea that there's something deceptive going on, I just don't really buy it. And the reason why anonymity was so important for civil rights activists is so they wouldn't be persecuted. And
right,
you're looking at more or less a similar thing.
How are you looking at a similar thing? I mean, when one is like individuals fearing for their lives because they want to fight the end of segregation, the other is saying that I'm Mark Steiner and I have $50 million. I'm throwing $2 million in this campaign so I can lower my taxes, but I don't want you to know who I am. What's going to happen to me if I do that?
Well, there's going to be a news story about you, and it's going to say, look at this person donating to, these evil pro-corporate conservative causes. That's basically the thing.
Well, couldn't the same be true? I mean, I'm Mark Steiner, head of this labor union, and look at the evil Mark Steiner in this labor union. I'm putting money into this. I mean, it's all the same.
Yeah, you have the right to do that.
But isn't that kind of influencing the political process with the anonymity?
Not in a pretty fundamental way, and you can't stop that without stifling free speech.
So where then does free speech begin and influence in political process end?
I mean, free speech doesn't mean anything unless it covers the speech that you hate. you know, and that free speech in America means that we need to put up with a lot of stuff that we find abhorrent, you know, and if those pro-corporate messages, you know, many people find them abhorrent, but, you know, free speech means that we need to tolerate them. Now, it does raise the issue, though, of how difficult it is to distinguish between true partisan activity, where you're trying to, you know, elect or defeat a candidate, and issue advocacy, which should receive much greater First Amendment protection. You know, that issue actually is at the heart of this particular story as well.
Well, we are going to come back to this particular story in the coming weeks. I think there's something we have to parse out for the American people listening to this program. And I want to thank Ari Berman. Thanks for joining us, contributing writer to The Nation. I know you're going to run for the next half hour, but we'll have you back very soon.
Thanks, Mark.
I want to thank Jordan Bloom, associate editor of The American Conservative, and Gabe Rotman, legislative counsel, policy advisor for ACLU's Washington Legislative Office, staying with us for the next half hour. Thank you both so much, and stay with us. We'll be back after the break. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We continue our conversation here, but we are shifting our focus to the question of civil liberties and what we have seen come out of the news about the seizing of phone records from the Associated Press. There's a lot of issue here, and I think that whether it's right, left, or in the middle, Americans have a right to be concerned about what effect this has on the freedom of the press and where our civil liberties are going. We are joined here for this conversation. Continuing with this is Jordan Bloom, associate editor of the American Conservative, and Gabe Rotman, legislative counsel, policy advisor in the ACLU's Washington Legislative Office, and Kevin Gastola. Did I say your last name correctly, Kevin? Is Kevin there?
That's correct.
Good. Thank you, Kevin. Make sure I didn't want to butcher your name. He's co-author of Truth and Consequences, The U.S. versus Bradley Manning, and writer for FiredogLake.com. And, Kevin, this is – it really is goes beyond the partisan warfare here. I think that we've seen kind of the silencing of whistleblowers in the Obama administration, which we'll talk about in a minute. But this is when we're talking about going after, in many cases here, the establishment press, which is where, whether you're right, left, small, digital organization, or large news organization, which is where much of the national conversation begins. Not all of it, but much of it. That's to talk about why you think this, what happened now with the Associated Press and the seizing of these records, should be something that makes us all have a bit of a chill running down our spine.
Well, the net effect is that it chills the ability of journalists to gather news from confidential news sources. And the prime reason that people should be concerned about this is that it has a particularly egregious effect or impact on national security stories, the things that you want to know that the government is doing in your name as a citizen to keep this country safe, that may, in retrospect, turn out to be something you wouldn't want your government to do. We found out about warrantless wiretapping under the Bush administration by confidential sources, found out about CIA secret prisons from confidential sources, Abu Ghraib abuse, that was a confidential source. Going back in history to the Pentagon Papers, initially before Daniel Ellsberg came out, that was a confidential news source coming forward. So in these instances where you have people talking about national security, like the drone program now, enhanced interrogation techniques, as the Bush administration likes to call them, and this is how we find out about what the government is doing in terms of national security, how they're really operating and carrying out policy.
So, and Jordan, this is not something that just lives in the Obama administration. We've been doing this through Bush. We did it 40 years ago, 50 years ago. But there's something about what's going on now that kind of grows out of all those things, Republican or Democrat, that I think that that is affecting our ability to understand what's going on in our country.
Oh, absolutely. I definitely agree with that. But the one thing that makes this, that it's happening in this administration unique, is because of this administration's particularly aggressive war on whistleblowers in attempt to shut down leaks. So there are a number of whistleblowers that are currently in prison. And it's pretty universally recognized that the Obama administration's gone after them much harder than even Bush did.
Gabe?
That's absolutely true, and this particular subpoena is astonishing in its breadth, and also the fact that the administration chose to delay notifying the Associated Press that it had been issued to the telephone company, and what that means, it's not just a delay; it means that the Associated Press was actually robbed of the ability to go to court before the records were turned over to challenge the propriety of this subpoena. And I'm not aware of a case where that's happened before. The case with the closest facts to this, the administration did what it was supposed to do. They went to the New York Times first. They negotiated over what they wanted. And when the New York Times said no, they went to court and fought it out as they were supposed to and eventually won. So it's really extraordinary what happened here.
I mean, this morning on Morning Joe, Kathleen Carroll, the Associated Press executive editor, says it was distressing that the Justice Department felt the need to seize our records and not tell us about it, as you were talking about, Kevin. And it's distressing to think that without our knowledge, someone is looking at our phone calls that we make in the course of daily business. Now, as somebody old enough to remember the late 60s and early 70s and the anti-war activity and other community organizing going on where people were tapping our phones all the time, but this is a little different, Kevin. We're talking about here about we're going after the press, going after America's right to know. This is nothing that anybody did the AP that exposed anything in Yemen that was not about to become public knowledge or interfere with their operations. This is talking about somebody trying to do investigative reporting to find out what's going on. That's what's so frightening here, Kevin.
Yeah, I think a key point that needs to be made is, yesterday, Obama made these remarks. He talks about that there will be no apologies for his Justice Department going and fishing around for records. You've had Eric Holder put five varies on Serious Leak, saying it was a very, 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 very serious leak, like the worst one he's seen since he became a prosecutor in 76. We've had all this hyperbole, but none of these officials want to admit that the CIA was in conversation with the Associated Press on this story, that the AP was consulting people, presumably was consulting now CIA Director John Brennan, who has admitted before a Senate hearing, during his confirmation hearing, admitted that he was talking to reporters about this story. And they were going to hold this. They weren't going to publish it until the operation was complete. There was no threat to the operation. There was never any risk to any American people. So now that they've gone and done this and there's a massive amount of outrage from, I think, the whole entire news community, really. The entire news business has come out in opposition, and now they're trying to say this is all about national security, and that's, you know, that's the refuge of scoundrels, typically, to say that it's national security to cover up misconduct.
So, Gabe Robin, how deep is this? How deep does this threaten our First Amendment rights? How much should we be worried about this, and what do you think our response should be?
Well, it's pretty bad. The facts, we still need to find out exactly what happened here. But, what it means is, well, first of all, just to step back, I mean, it's important to point out that the freedom of the press, as protected by the First Amendment, you know, it doesn't protect the press. This isn't about the press. It's about us. And it's about our ability to know what the government is doing. And that's especially important in national security cases where the government has vast authority to keep what it's doing secret. So this is really going to put a chill on reporting, you know, in many ways, including reporters are going to be wary of giving sources assurances of confidentiality because they know that they can't keep that promise because the government's going to break it. Sources, right, are going to be very wary of even taking phone calls from the press because they know that if they even get the phone call, it's quite possible they'll show up on the phone records that are seized by the Department of Justice in a leak investigation. You know, and then reporters are not going to be able to rely on telephones to do their job. You know, I was on a panel yesterday where reporters are talking about having to start using burner phones where, you know, they'll get throwaway cell phones, give them to the source, they'll use one, and they'll have to throw them away after a certain amount of time. So, you know, the scope of this particular subpoena, you know, really it poses grave issues for the First Amendment.
I mean, Kevin, makes me think: do journalists not have to become like drug dealers, hiding what we do?
Yeah, I think. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Kevin. I'm sorry.
Well, I want to let the other guy get in, but I think you're going to have to become drug dealers. I think you have to act like spies, and I think it's important to point out that. Last year, there was all this hysteria around leaks. It was happening on Capitol Hill with Senator Dianne Feinstein and people like Representative Mike Rogers and even Peter King. All these individuals with Lieberman was still in the Senate, and you heard John McCain, and they were all talking about how there needed to be aggressive prosecutions. And people need to understand that this is the natural result. This is what happens with these leaks prosecutions, that now in this age with this vast surveillance state, that the government uses its powers to not only go into all the communications of their own government employees, but they're also going to use it to go after the records that the phone companies, the telecommunications companies have, so that they can put together their cases. And I think the one other thing I want to get in here is that there have been this record number of leakers, of alleged whistleblowers prosecuted by the Obama administration. But not only that, you've had the administration claiming national security exemptions for Freedom of Information Act requests. You've had them retroactively classifying information that government employees go on television to talk about. And then by doing that, this makes it possible to fire them and put them on trial and go after them. This is the case with Federal Air Marshal Robert McClain under the TSA. So, what people have to realize is that there is this huge effort by government under the Obama administration and even probably going back to the Bush administration to control the flow of information.
And it seems to me, Jordan, that this is almost a perfect storm of both, and this is not a semi-conservatism, because I think conservatives are as upset about this as liberals or progressives or anybody else in this country, but that it's almost a perfect storm Republican senators and congressmen and some conservative Democrats and even liberal Democrats calling for these investigations of leaks and saying we've got to tighten this up and go after the press, go after leaks and administrations, whether it's Bush or Obama, who – and especially I think Democrats in some ways who want to prove themselves tough on leaks and where and on divulging information that really is a major threat to where we're going.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And the way that they, you know, play off of each other symbiotically in a really toxic way, I think it really is the key danger here. Because you had those Republicans, just as Kevin said, calling for leaks investigations. But it must be said that the reason they were doing that is because a lot of these leaks, such as the one of the New York Times about the kill lists, were actually coming from the administration, and there was the impression that they were deliberately leaked to make the administration look strong. So that's what they were playing off of. And, you know, maybe it was okay to call for an investigation of that stuff, but the net effect is a ramping up of cracking down on leaks.
Because what we have here in some ways, Gabe Rotman, is the Department of Justice saying that they can really do whatever they want. That if their own guidelines or the press doesn't agree to letting them see certain things, that they don't have to have a subpoena. That telephone records of any member of the news media, without exception, can be authorized by the Attorney General if they are determined to be a threat to national security. How do you stop that?
Well, it's very likely that what was used here was a grand jury subpoena, and so the grand jury is supposed to be the check against government overreach. But, you know, grand jury, the old joke when it comes to indictment is that, you know, a grand jury will indict a ham sandwich. The grand jury is the only person that they hear from is the government. There's no adversarial process. So the subpoena itself is almost a paper tiger in terms of preventing government overreach when the government really wants to do it. But the most troubling part of the story, in addition to the fact that the subpoena covered the outgoing calls of 20 phone lines in offices where more than 100 Associated Press reporters worked, you know, even more troubling than that is the fact that the Department of Justice elected to delay notifying the Associated Press, which prevented them from going to court to challenge the subpoena. And, you know, that's really important because it's possible that what happened here, and as the facts come out, we need to look into this particularly. It's possible that what happened here was that the administration, having followed its guidelines and its regulations, which require it to go and negotiate with the news organization before seeking the information, having done that in the past where there's been a delay in getting the information, that they elected to delay notification in order to expedite the process. You know, that's not the standard they're supposed to be following. The only time they should be delaying notifying the news organization is when it threatens the investigation. And, you know, that angle to this particular story is something that really we need to look into.
And what does that mean to you, Kevin, look into? How do we look into it, and what do we do?
Well, I mean, basically, the New York Times has already made this point, I believe, that the records could not have been destroyed because they're in the possession of the phone companies.
Right.
So whatever threat the Justice Department wants us to believe was posed to the investigation, I mean, AP wasn't going to destroy the phone records that showed reporters were talking to individuals. They talked to 550 people before they ultimately decided to seize the records. At least that's what Deputy Attorney General Jim Cole has said to the AP. And what that's a lot of people to talk to before making the decision, do I have these records? That suggests to me that this is even more of a fishing expedition than it appeared prior, because if you didn't find who it was out of those 550 individuals, it seems to me there's a good chance that you might not figure out where this information was coming from or the particular person you're trying to pin down. And I think when everything is said and done, the big thing here going forward is what's sort of awkward and perverse. I don't know if you want to pivot into this, but the Obama administration is sort of calculating how it wants to move forward, and it's putting forth their support for a media shield law now. And I think that has its importance. But what people need to understand is that as they would like it to be passed, it currently has carved into it a national security exception, which is carved into many of the policies that the Obama administration has supported. And this would not have helped the Associated Press. The wide consensus is that as the media shield law is being proposed now and introduced in Senate and in the House, it would not have changed the game here, that they still could have proceeded with their fishing expedition.
So I wonder in some ways, if there's something we need to think about as in our democracy, as citizens here, as we look at this, whether or not there's something Jordan Bloom within power itself. I mean, President Barack Obama, when he was senator, supported the Shield Law, was opposed to what Republicans wanted to do in terms of against the codification of some of the protections of journalists. But now the exact opposite is happening. Is there something itself about power that we, the citizens, have to stand up to ensure that that power doesn't ensure doesn't block us from having the freedoms we want? Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, because something happens, it seems, that people that turns when human beings get in power themselves, even when they said they were for something before they got there.
Well, right, yeah, there are a number of factors in that. There's, you know, the desire for, like, you never want to preside over some sort of national security disaster if you're a politician. So you want to do all you can to make sure that that's locked down. But also you have just sheer bureaucratic momentum. None of these agencies want to give up power, and they have the ability to influence politics such as they can protect it. And I think, like, the example of that is Watergate, which is, you know, those leaks were arranged to as part of basically a succession dispute.
Right, and Gabe, you know, when we talk about Watergate, if you tie Watergate into this, this anniversary of the beginning of the Senate investigations of the House investigations of Watergate that happened in 1973, there was an outrage that happened because of Watergate, maybe because it was fueled in some parts by a movement against the war and the movement that happened in the late 60s, early 60s that helped fuel that in the American consciousness that doesn't seem to exist right now, and that's part of our problem.
Yeah, I mean, I think Watergate had sort of a cascading effect where, you know, shoes were dropping every day, where and it was, you know, additional malfeasance by the administration. What is interesting in the point that you were raising earlier is, you know, this is actually sort of a problem with the classification system as a whole. You know, leaks are, you know, vilified by folks in Congress and the administration. But when it comes down to it, there's really no incentive for the government not to classify information. And so all kinds of stuff that really shouldn't be classified and that's absolutely in the public interest gets classified. And so, you know, these leaks are part of the news media trying to do its job and fill its function in our democracy and it's under our Constitution, you know, in the face of this broken classification system. So, you know, it's all nice and good to yell at the leakers, but, you know, as Kevin was pointing out earlier, you know, this broken classification system, if we didn't have an aggressive press corps, we wouldn't have known about Abu Ghraib, we wouldn't have known about torture, we wouldn't have known about CIA black sites. So, you know, that's also something that we need to address here.
Is there a line somewhere, Kevin Gazzola, for you, between the public's right to know, our right to understand what is going on inside our government when it comes to issues like this and the issue of national security? That's the line that I think confuses a lot of Americans, why they get confused between that and our civil liberties.
I think that there is a line, but in my experience covering these issues, this tension between national security and I'll say the public's right to know, or transparency and openness, it would seem that this is more of a framing that suits the people who are in power. You know, every time that they've come out, any time that the Obama administration, I would suggest that probably the Bush administration was no different. When they come out and they have these press conferences and they talk about balancing the national security and freedom of the press, every time when you go back to the decisions, the policies, the decisions to go prosecute individuals, they're always erring on the side of so-called national security interests. It doesn't ever come down on the other side,
right,
or press freedom, in my opinion. And so the key issue for me as I look at this is that, you know, everybody needs to know this information. I think we have a right to know if our government is committing crimes, if they're engaged in corruption, and the Congress doesn't have this interest in doing its oversight duty. It's not going to hold a church committee and go through all of the different national security agencies' records and have a public airing of of what was done during the Bush administration. It's not going to tell us what the Obama administration is doing now with the, you know, going off and targeting and killing people with drones or missiles from, you know, Air Force and in Yemen, Somalia, or Pakistan, which deserves extra scrutiny. And so what we have is I think that, you know, I don't have much of a compulsion to be deferential towards national security. I actually think we should be really in favor of the public's right to know, just because as a citizenry, we need to push back against this vast national security state.
And Jordan Bloom, I mean, I think that what Kevin said is important. We only have a few minutes left. But for what, no matter what your political perspective is here, you know, when we're seeing this what they attacked here and this Yemen CIA story with the AP, they even went after people like Adam Goldman's records and Matt Apuzzo, who won the Pulitzer Prize for uncovering the New York Police Department surveillance of American Muslim communities. I mean, so this is like going after rock-solid journalism, exposing what happens in our country. And I think that all of us together, united, cross right and left, have to stand up to this.
Absolutely. I think I'm in complete agreement with Kevin on this one. It's pretty undeniably true that, you know, framing the question in terms of what our secrecy, you know, this needs to be secret because of national security. Just the fact that it's the government making that determination biases the whole equation in its favor.
Gabe? So as an organization that really works hard sometimes, even though you look at it as a left-wing group, but an organization that tries to expand the spectrum, where do we proceed?
Well, I think we have to take it back to the Shield Law, but as Kevin was pointing out, the version that the president asked Senator Schumer to introduce and for Congress to pass, you know, has this national security exception that you can drive a Mack truck through.
Yes.
And in addition to the exception, it actually requires a judge. So the only thing that it does we shouldn't discount this. I mean, it does require the government to go to a judge when it's seeking this information, you know, but it requires the judge to defer to, you know, specific factual findings as presented by the government, you know, which just broadens this national security exception to make it, you know, to make it a nullity. So, you know, but Congress does need to pass a Shield Law, and Congress should get behind comprehensive Shield legislation that would prevent what happened here from happening again. It would either narrow the scope of the subpoena, ensure that the AP is notified so it can go to court, you know, or ensure that a judge can actually look into it and find out whether the subpoena is warranted at all. So, you know, that's where we need to go.
Well, this has been fascinating. I appreciate the three of you taking all this time with us. Gabe Rotman, Legislative Counsel, Policy Advisor in the ACLU's Washington Legislative Office. Jordan Bloom, Associate Editor of the American Conservative. Kevin Gastola, who is co-author of Truth and Consequences of the U.S. versus Bradley Manning and writer for FireDogLake.com. Thank the three of you so much. I look forward to you all coming back. We have to stay on top of this.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks very much.
Thank you all. And we're going to be linking to all these men's work on our website at steinershow.org to read what they've been thinking, saying, and writing so we can all stay on top of this together. We're going to take a very brief break and come back and visit some folks who are taking an unusual journey to North Korea. Don't go away.